Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Get Set Go. Get comprehensive car insurance today at getsetgo.ie.
Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1.
Right, let's find out about the people who work in our cancer care hospital system. Dr. Derville Collins works in the country's biggest hospital, Cork University Hospital, so she's live from our Cork studio. Good afternoon, Dr. Collins.
Good afternoon, Oliver. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. You're very welcome. You're a Corkonian, but only by choice, aren't you? You're kind of from everywhere.
Correct. Adopted Corkonian, yes.
You have some Cork on your father's side, is that right? But you shifted around a lot when you were a kid.
Yeah, that's right. So I suppose generationally I would have family based in Cork and Kerry. Traditionally, that's probably where my father's side goes back to, but my mother's side would be very Tipperary. But yeah, my dad was a director at the United Nations, so we lived in the Middle East for much of our life, travelling yeah. to different countries and many different, so Jordan and Syria and Jerusalem, so lots of amazing places that he was brought to with his work as a director and predominantly with the United Nations Relief Works Agency, so a lot of work with the Palestinians. So yeah, I came back to Ireland when I was about 12.
You were a kid when the Gulf War broke out. Is that what sort of made the decision for your family to bring you home?
Yeah, so we had intended on coming home, but actually because of the Gulf War, we were evacuated out. So that was kind of when we started to make the move back to Ireland. But actually, the Gulf War was such a dramatic period for people living in that area that actually we were, you know, evacuated out for safety reasons. But we lived in Cyprus for a number of months before we eventually got home. So a very dramatic and traumatic time.
Yeah. And before that, as a child, you're growing up in the Middle East, I presume, in all these international schools surrounded by Americans, Brits, people from everywhere?
That's right, everywhere. So we were very much part of the, went to American and international schools, filled with lots of diplomat children and people work with the United Nations from every single part of the globe. So very much a very diverse upbringing.
This would have been late 1980s and you're living in the Palestinian areas, the occupied parts of Israel, are you? Is
that correct? Yeah, that's right.
What was that? What are your memories of that?
Yeah, so I suppose from when I was a very small child, I lived in Saudi Arabia before we moved in. So I suppose it was only as I got older that I started to realise the political undercurrents. And my parents were incredibly supportive and protective, obviously, over the, you know, any of the traumatic side of things. But mm-hmm. certainly when we lived in Jerusalem, we were very much in the thick of things.
Yeah.
And we did have very significant experiences, I suppose, you know, coming home from school, where we'd be pulled over by the Israeli police and the army. So there were multiple experiences that were, you know, as a child, I suppose children are very resilient, so you sort of just got along with it. But mm-hmm. I must say a shout out to my parents for being, you know, I suppose protecting me from the danger of the situation and everything.
Were you able to play outside? Do you remember kind of feeling that this was a normal upbringing?
For me, it was a normal upbringing, and I suppose a lot of my friends were in a similar situation, and moving from school to school, so sometimes you'd move every year, was very much a normal part of life. And my parents gave us an incredibly stable, I suppose, environment at home that meant you never felt that you were, you know, sinking at sea, and there was always home to come back to. So that sort of became the hearth of my life. But yeah, we did play outside, but in a very controlled fashion.
Right.
So we'd be very much, you know, any activities that we would do would very much be based within the school grounds or within the kind of residential compound that we'd often end up living in. Now, there were parts of our stay that we did very much live with the Palestinians
yeah.
in Palestinian apartment complex, but some of it was a little bit more protected, especially as the years went on and the political undercurrent started to get a little bit more tense.
When you come home then, it's to Kilkenny, is it?
Correct, yes.
So you would have had a great education in all these fabulous schools that you've been going around the world, but it was disjointed and fractured in terms of your own world as a kid, trying to make friends and find your way in the universe.
Yeah, I suppose it was. You get very good at making friends very quickly. You become, well, I would consider myself very very easygoing and very easy to fit into different situations. But it is difficult saying goodbye to people continuously over the years, even though I'm still in contact with people that who are now, you know, in America and all over the world, in Australia. But yeah, so that was a little, that was disjointed. But at the same time, it does teach resilience, both, you know, and the ability to adapt to situations. So there are, you know, no matter what situation anyone is in, there are lessons to be learned and skills to be developed.
So you didn't really have a kind of a permanent home per se, Kilkenny, then a bit of Dublin, then a bit of London, and eventually you start your you start studying medicine in UCD.
Yeah, so home is where my family is. So my family, obviously, when I came home from the Middle East, would have been based in Kilkenny, although my father stayed in Gaza, where he stayed on for a number of years. Not being a family station, we would have had to stay away. So he ended up not spending much of his year and ended up, I suppose, dedicating and devoting his life to the Palestinian people in Gaza. So his heart, he unfortunately passed a number of years ago, but his heart would be broken by what's going on in Gaza at the moment, as are all of ours. But I suppose he was so close to the front line at all levels. But yes, yeah, so they eventually moved to the United States, my mother and him, as director of UNFPA. So we had that aspect of home as well. But Kilkenny was home, and then I went to college in Dublin to study medicine and spent Dublin many years in Dublin, and then on to London and now Cork. They finally adopted me down here.
And you're an oncologist now. It's an important role. When you were specialising or choosing what to specialise in, you had different kind of ideas in your mind.
Yeah, I think it's always no more than it's hard for someone going through their leaving cert to make a decision about what they want to do when they go to college and what they want to do for the rest of their lives. Similarly, I suppose you come out of medicine and you're still maybe a little uncertain about what you want to do. So I started out training as a surgeon, as a general surgeon, and did 7 years of surgical training, which was going down the route of being a breast surgeon in the end. As part of that, I did a PhD in oncology at the Royal College of Surgeons with Professor Leonie Young, and that really started to wake me up to, I suppose, the amazing opportunities and developments and advancements in cancer treatments and the understanding of how cancer works and how it reacts to different treatments. So that's what actually made me finally make a decision to retrain. So I went back to the beginning, trained as a medical doctor, and then went straight into oncology from there.
And that PhD you mentioned, it was lab-based, and that's, you started 20 years ago, so you've seen phenomenal changes.
Gosh, was it that long ago, Oliver? yes, it doesn't feel that long ago, but I suppose in some respects it does. And it was lab-based, very much in the lab with the most incredible scientists who are doing so much to advance and progress cancer treatment. So, yeah, over that 20-year period, I have seen huge changes in cancer treatment, really exciting changes and really hopeful for the future as we go forward.
What interested you about cancer? Why did you kind of think to yourself, I want to go into this area and spend my life? And what felt like quite a difficult role, often hopeless, as it would have been years ago?
Yeah, so there's two parts that drew me to oncology. So I mentioned the scientific side of things. So our understanding of cancer, what causes it, what makes it grow, what causes it to respond to some treatments and be resistant to others, all that is down to the actual kind of underlying molecular biology. So that is I find that fascinating, and I find our understanding of that is growing. Our treatments because of that understanding is increasing, and that has been one big draw. But I suppose the huge thing for me is the patients themselves. And cancer can be such a life-changing diagnosis. And, you know, when you give that diagnosis to someone, you have completely altered their world. And, you know, in some respects, you know, it's great to be able to say, you know, you have cancer, but we have really good treatments and we can cure this. Yeah. But unfortunately, that's not the case in all cases. But in the many cases, we can say, you know, we can't, you know, cure it, but let's focus on, you know, creating a plan, getting you some treatment and buying some time. And, you know, that's That varies depending on the cancer type, unfortunately, but mm-hmm. it is improving all the time. And the future is, as I said, is very bright as we go forward and we learn more about cancer and improve our treatments.
So it's not that long ago you used to just have chemo for some treatments.
Yeah.
But the last 10, 15 years, there are huge changes, huge improvements.
Yeah, so when I would have started, chemotherapy would have very much been the backbone. There would have been some new treatments coming, but, you know, they really wouldn't have been that earth-shattering across the board. There were some cancers we did make some improvements, breast cancer. There's some rarer cancers we did, you know, improve significantly. But the majority of the cancers was just chemotherapy for all. You know, you have one cancer. But that has changed enormously. And actually, for an oncologist, it's been challenging because we have had to learn on the job. So I wouldn't have learned a lot of this in my medical training. I would have learned it along the way through, you know, continued professional development, through my experience at the Royal Marsden Hospital. So for example, you know, we look at the mutations within cancer. Now we have what we call molecular tumour boards. And I actually am the clinical lead of the Irish Molecular Tumour Board, which helps to offer interpretations of a lot of these mutations and offer recommendations on treatment. And that's available for, you know, patients who have had testing for their cancer, their mutations. And that's a whole new sort of area of oncology, this precision or personalised oncology that is growing all the time.
And when you talk about the mutations, is this when you think you've got a hold on cancer, but then it has changed, it's mutated, and then you need to fight that new version of it?
So cancer, by its very development, is actually a mutation. So something has gone wrong within a normal cell, a mutation usually, or we call them kind of variations because they can be quite different and diverse. And that has resulted in the cancer. So sometimes they can be targeted by a very specific tablet or treatment that very much focuses on that treatment and can cause the cancer to reduce, shrink, control, and hopefully, you know, in some cases can actually cure the cancer. In other cases, it controls it for a period of time. But you're right to say, Oliver, that resistance can occur. New mutations can develop. Cancer is smart and it evolves quickly. So there are the ability to continuously be looking at cancer and identifying these mutations to try and improve the treatment plan for patients.
All of this means that when you heard someone had stage 4 cancer, they had a very short term prognosis, essentially, didn't they? They weren't going to last very long. But those people can now, with these changes, in some cases, live for years and years.
Correct. So I talked a little, you know, we mentioned the mutations that we can find. But actually, one of the huge change treatments that we've had that has really made a difference to stage 4 and I suppose previously considered incurable patients is a treatment called immunotherapy, which is a family of drugs, immune checkpoint inhibitors. And we've got a lot of novel immunotherapy drugs coming, like vaccines and that sort of therapy. They now get the person's own immune system to target and remove cancer. And actually we're seeing, and I treat a lot of lung cancer patients, we are seeing lung cancer patients now that we gave immunotherapy to 10 years ago that are still alive, would have been told they were incurable, and lung cancer in its advanced, you know, stage would have been, a very much a short outcome. But now we're seeing, not in everyone, unfortunately, but we are seeing some patients gather really good results.
And melanoma as well.
Kidney cancer as well. And it's coming for lots of, I do cervical cancer. It's also an important part of that treatment plan. So it's coming in many different cancer types, sometimes in some small groups of those cancer types, but it's improving all the time.
I remember when the breakthrough came for the COVID vaccine and it was fast-tracking the allowance of RNA vaccines. And at the time they said, we will have loads of these RNA-style vaccines for certain cancers. Are those breakthroughs still kind of working through the process? Are they starting to emerge?
Yeah, they are starting to come. So we're seeing them emerge so obviously drug development and the development of compounds for treatment of cancer is actually quite a long process. And I did a lot of this in the Royal Marsden Hospital where I worked with the drug development unit. So, you know, drugs that I would have been working on in the Royal Marsden Hospital are really only coming out now. So COVID was a fascinating time because there was this rapid speed of vaccine and treatment development because the whole world kind of got behind the wheel to do it.
Yeah.
Cancer is a little, I will say a little slower. It is definitely speeding up. There's definitely more and more treatments coming to the fore. But we still do have, I suppose, a delay in accessing them. There still is, you know, from when we see the phase three studies that show a benefit for patients, we're still waiting a few years before we actually can get them to our patients, which is something that needs to improve as well. But yeah, so we are seeing a lot of these new technologies, especially harnessing the immune system for attacking cancer, coming through clinical trials. And actually, Cancer Trials Ireland has a vaccine study for lung cancer as one example, which is open at the moment in certain countries in the country.
There's loads of work going on. You're going to be on the TV tonight on RT1. Any Given Day is the show. It started last week and goes behind the scenes at Cork University Hospital. You hope people will just take a little bit of hope, a bit of a lift from it, that the health service news isn't all negative. You're working away hard. Isn't that the idea?
Yeah. So Any Given Day at Cork University Hospital, a 6-part docuseries looking at multiple patient stories with multiple medical issues coming through through the emergency department. But sometimes, you know, there's cancer stories and there's multiple other stories being told and the patients are at the centre. But I am hoping that, and I know it will, show the incredible positivity that exists within our health service. And I know there's a lot of negativity about, you know, beds and trolleys in the emergency department.
Yeah. We need the good news.
Yeah,
for sure.
You don't see all the
Dr.
Derville
Collins,
on.
I'm sorry I'm out of time. That's Any Given Day, Cork University Hospital tonight, 9:35 p.m. on RT1 on the player. Dr. Collins, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Oliver.
That's all our business today. Rachel English is on the news at 1. We'll talk again tomorrow. Slán.